Talking History on News Talk.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, the history of the world in 10 minutes. The story of the Irish Americans who caused a crisis in citizenship when they joined the Fenians, and the Kerry men and women who fought for Irish independence. And to end the show, we'll find out what happened when writers took over in Germany in 1918. Last week, we looked at the life and work of Emily Dickinson and explored her views on death and her remarkable legacy. And if you want to listen back to this or any of our older shows, just go to our website, newstalk.com, or go directly to iTunes. We begin, though, with the Oxford Illustrated History of the World. An ambitious new book encompasses the whole span of human history. It brings together some of the world's leading historians to tell the 200,000-year story of the world, from the emergence of Homo sapiens through to the 21st century. It's called The Oxford Illustrated History of the World, and it's published in hardback by Oxford University Press. It costs £30 sterling, so about €34. The editor is Felipe Fernandez Armesto. And Felipe, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
It's very good of you to have me.
Can we tell precisely when human history began?
Depends what you mean by human. I mean, if you by human you mean Homo sapiens, the earliest known fossils of Homo sapiens are about 160,000-180,000 years old. So we usually reckon the emergence of Homo sapiens about 200,000 years. But of course, you know, we know from the theory of evolution that you can't draw a line at any point in evolution and say, you know, this is where humankind begins, because, of course, before Homo sapiens, you've got a whole, you know, dynasty of earlier hominids and hominins, and before then, you've got, you know, these sort of pithecanthropoi, as paleoanthropologists call them. But for the Oxford Illustrated History, we said, let's go with our species, because, you know, if you're trying to look at history objectively, you want to say, what is it that's special about Homo sapiens? What is it that makes our past different from that of all the other species on this planet? And I mean, I think we're a really interesting species. I mean, we're kind of weird because we have so much history, because we have so much culture, because the way we live and think and behave and marry and burn are so different from those of all other species, all of whom are far more consistent in their behavior. Whereas you take a Homo sapiens from Ireland, another Homo sapiens from Africa, another Homo sapiens from Australia or America, and they're all going to behave in different ways. So to me, the really big question is, why is that? And that's why we focused the Oxford Illustrated History of the World on just one species on this planet.
It's an elegant volume. You might think that trying to cram 200,000 years of history into a book would lead to something that you would need an entire bookshelf to contain, but it's elegant, it's compact. So how did you approach that task then?
Well, thank you very much for the compliment, Patrick. I mean, I think you can do anything at any length. You know, when my children were little, they used to play a game in the car in which one of them would give the other a great work of literature, and the other boy would have to summarize it in the style of a Hollywood shout line. So, I mean, I remember when they did Macbeth, they came up with, he wanted to be king, she wanted him to be king even more. And then when they did the Bible, they came up with, he chose his own people, but he died for all mankind. So, you know, you can do anything at any length. And, you know, to me, I mean, I think you can almost do the whole history of the world in two words. I mean, I wish it could be done in one word, because that would have to be a magic word. But I kind of summarize it in two words, divergence and convergence, because the history of humankind is the history of this multiplication of culture, multiplication of ways of life. That's a history of divergence in which, you know, over that 200,000 years, we've gradually split into different communities and we've forged individual ways of doing things community by community. And then there's a parallel story of convergence, where from time to time human communities come together, they establish contact, they exchange culture, and they become more like each other. So, I mean, I'm not quite sure how many words there are in the Oxford Illustrated History of the World. I think it's something like 150,000. So you could say that's 149,998 too many.
You could have got your children to do a tagline as if it was a movie trailer.
Well, you know, I mean, I have sometimes tried to get them to do that with my books, but I'm afraid, is one allowed to say on Irish radio that they take the piss, or is that
Oh, I think we can get away with that.
Oh, thank you very much. Take it. Well, don't say that, but they take the piss. If I try to make them do it.
Very good. There's so many different themes in the book. It deals with states, empires, the unlocking of energy, but it also deals with great environmental catastrophes, and it shows how that leads to changes and sometimes dramatic convulsions.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, one of the curious features of our species is that we seem to have a tremendous amount of free will. I mean, far more than other species. We craft the environment to suit our own human purposes. But you know, there are times when the environment sort of takes its revenge and imposes on us tremendous catastrophes. But to me, the really big story of the environment, and there's nothing particularly original about this, I mean, most environmental scientists would agree with me here. The really big story, the really surprising story, is the story of our impact on the environment. I that's only part of the story because the environment also impacts on us and often, you know, kills us off at times. But that's our impact on the environment that's a really big story. And, you know, I think there are three standout moments in that. One is the invention of agriculture, in which we kind of reversed evolution by creating what I call unnatural selection, by creating species to feed ourselves, which we produced by, you know, hybridization and by speciation, by tinkering with nature in a radical way that produces these new species that wouldn't exist on the planet if it weren't for the human context. Well, second moment comes about 500 years ago when ecological exchange, when those vast new journeys across the world by ships, almost all of them originating in Europe, carry life forms across the ocean to continents where they'd never existed before. And that introduces a new theme in evolution, which I call a convergent theme, because up till then, evolution had been diverging continent by continent ever since continental drift began about 150 million years ago. So when you get one species intervening in that process to reverse something that's been happening for 150 million years, you know, that's a really big story. And then, of course, the final big human intervention in nature is genetic modification, which we're in the process of applying, and we don't yet know whether the result will be triumph or tragedy.
Wars also feature heavily, and these major conflicts in history. And I wonder, are there any lessons learned or anything that could help influence us today?
Well, of course, people love wars. You know, I mean, the reason why there are so many wars in history books and history television programs and history magazines isn't that there have been a lot of wars. It's just that people love wars. You know, I think it was Thomas Hardy who said that, you know, peace is poor reading, but war makes rattling good history. And so I think the big lesson is really that we've underestimated the extent to which we're a peaceful and collaborative species. And obviously there's an awful lot of violence, a lot of mayhem and killing, but in a curious way, you know, there's kind of less of that than we've traditionally suppose. We've exaggerated because we love reading about it and we love watching it on the screen. So I think, I mean, my first lesson in that respect is to say we are much more peaceful and collaborative than we commonly think. I don't buy the idea that, you know, we're a species of demonic males and that we're committed by evolution to being aggressive. I think the reverse is true. we've got no hope of surviving as a species without peace and collaboration. I think that's the message of the 200,000 years of existence we've had so far. And if we want another 200,000 or longer years of existence as a species, we've got to take that lesson on board and learn to collaborate resolutely and fruitfully.
Very good. Well, congratulations on the book. It's the Oxford Illustrated History of the World. It's published in hardback by Oxford University Press and costs about €34. The editor and the person behind this extraordinary achievement, Felipe Fernandez Armesto. And Felipe, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you so much, Patrick. It's been great talking to you.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. A new book tells the riveting story of 40 Irish Americans who set off to fight for Irish independence, only to be arrested by the British authorities and accused of treason. It's a story of an international conflict that dragged the United States and Britain to the brink of war. And it's now been told brilliantly by Lucy E. Salyer in her new book, Under the Starry Flag, how a band of Irish Americans joined the Fenian Revolt and sparked a crisis over citizenship. It's published in hardback by Harvard University Press and costs £21.95 sterling. So about €24. And Lisa, you're very welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
So in Ireland here, we're probably familiar with some parts of the story, but not the full extent of it. We're aware of American, Irish-American involvement in the struggle for freedom in Ireland, but this brings a whole new set of issues to the story.
Yes, and for Americans, know very little about the Fenians, I found out as I was doing this research, and practically nobody knows about the forgotten rite of expatriation, which is what this whole incident led to, a big fight over citizenship.
So talk to me about the group of these Irish Americans. We're talking about the spring of 1867. They wanted to support the Fenian Rising that was planned for March of that year. What happened to them?
Well, after the Civil War, as many of your listeners will know, the Fenian Brotherhood really gained strength in the United States, and some of them wanted to go invade Canada as a tactic in striking a blow for Irish freedom. But this Aaron's Hope expedition was part of another group who thought they should go directly to Ireland to help foment rebellion there. And so when this long-awaited rising happened on March 5th, 1867, they were very excited in New York, and there was a call put out to bring men and arms to Ireland to help with the rising. So the Aaron's Hope expedition was sailed in April of 1867 with the goal of helping that rising. So it was a really pretty rundown brigantine that they were able to get their hands on. It was called the Jack Mel, and they had about 5,000 rifles and revolvers on board, 1.5 million rounds of ammunition, and 3 pieces of artillery. So they sailed off to Ireland. But by the time they get to Sligo, where they first drop anchor, they find out that the rising had been put down. And so they are told to go to the south of Ireland in the hopes that there were pockets of resistance still alive there. And they end up off the coast of Dungarvan. And by this point, the expedition has really started to fall apart. They don't have much food or water, and the men have turned mutinous, or some of them have at least. And so the leaders decide to land the men off the coast of Dungarvan, where they're promptly arrested by the Irish Coast Guard, and they're put on trial for treason.
And this is where it gets interesting then, because they claim that they say, well, even though they were born in Ireland, they had become American citizens, so they insisted that they should be treated as American citizens.
Exactly, right. Some were born in the United States, and they were native-born Americans, but the key issue really centered on the people who had been born in Ireland, like John Warren, who's one of the main characters. He had been born in Clonakilty in County Cork. And so they say, you know, we're American citizens. We left Ireland, and we swore our allegiance to the United States. But the British respond, once a subject, always a subject, and that only death could release them from their obligations and their allegiance to the Queen.
And this became then an international spectacle because there was huge interest around the globe in it. Talk to me about the right of expatriation. That became the key issue then.
Yes, and it's so funny. When I first started working on this, I knew very little about what this right of expatriation was. And I think today we think about it as losing one's citizenship. But in the 19th century, Americans especially really defended this right to give up your citizenship. So the right of expatriation is really the right to leave your native land and the right to become a citizen somewhere else. And Americans, you know, as an immigrant nation, they really championed this right. But sending countries, Britain and Europe, really resisted this idea that people could change their nationality all on their, you know, just because they wanted to. So there had been a huge conflict brewing between the United States, Britain, and Europe ever since the American Revolution, which was in some ways a mass act of expatriation. And the United States had really adopted this idea that people should be able to choose their allegiance. And this ran, you know, straight against these ideas of perpetual allegiance.
Talk to me about what happened to the men on Aaron's Hope then. That was there a double standard in the way they were treated between those who were born in America and those who were born in Ireland?
Absolutely, and that's really what sparked the whole controversy. And I should say that the Fenians were very aware of this long history of controversy. So they knew they were stepping into an international sore point, and they were really determined to make the best use of it. So what happened was John Warren is put on trial, and he insists that he should be treated as an American citizen. That meant a lot of things to him. That meant that he should be able to reach out to the U.S. consulate for intervention and protection. It also meant for him that he should be able to make use of a pretty rare procedure in English and English common law, which is called the mixed jury. And that's when you had a jury of half aliens and half subjects. So it was meant to be fair to somebody who might not be a subject and be an outsider. So the Irish authorities, the judges, said, no, you're a subject. You can't have this kind of jury. When the native-born Americans are brought up for trial, they are given the mixed jury, although their trials fall apart pretty quickly because they can't find enough aliens to serve on the jury. So the bottom line is that John Warren is convicted of treason and sentenced to 15 years at hard labor, whereas William Nagle, his co-commander on the Aaron's Hope, is released and sent home. And this plays out, this really sparks fury in the United States. That native-born Americans are getting treated better internationally than naturalized citizens are. And it really sparks a chord partly because there's already a lot of discontent among foreign-born Americans that they're somehow second-class citizens. And so this is what is key in turning the domestic political debate in favor of the Fenians. It becomes a much bigger issue than just Irish-American nationalists. It becomes a key issue about whether the United States is going to protect all of its citizens equally.
And this is something then that has a long-term impact then, because Congress passes that Expatriation Act, and this is something then that has an important legacy in American history.
It does, and it's an act that has gained little notice. I think we're so focused on the 14th Amendment, which is really important in establishing the right of birthright citizenship, which is currently under debate once again. But this right to give up one's citizenship is also sort of the flip side of that 14th Amendment. But it's also important for British history. The British passed in 1870 a new Naturalization Act, which also is much more liberal in allowing people to become naturalized in Britain, but also explicitly recognizes the right to expatriate. So the British drop what they called this ancient doctrine of perpetual allegiance. And there are also 12 treaties signed between the United States and Britain and many German states and other countries, which explicitly recognize the right of migration and the right of people to change their citizenship. And so this is not just about American history. It's really about a key moment in international history as mass migration is really becoming a fact of life. And countries are trying to decide, you know, how to carve up jurisdiction over various people.
Very good. And it's a story that has a relevance even up to the present day. Well, Lucy, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Well, thank you.
The book is called Under the Starry Flag, How a Band of Irish Americans Joined the Fenian Revolt and Sparked a Crisis Over Citizenship. Published in hardback by Harvard University Press, costs about €24. The author, Lucy Salyer. And Lucy, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. A new book, Fighting for the Cause, by well-known Kerry historian Dr. Tim Horgan, tells the stories of some of the kingdom's extraordinary men and women who fought for an Irish Republic. And I'm delighted to welcome him to the show tonight. The book is published in paperback by Mercier Press, costs €19.99. Tim, you're very welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
It's a fascinating book because these are stories that span the 19th century and the 20th century. How did you decide to go about telling their stories?
Well, I suppose this is really the story of the struggle for freedom as told from the perspective of those men and women who participated in it. These were people who would have played significant parts but rarely get into the recorded chronicles of the time, either because they didn't give statements to the Bureau of Military History or because they had died prematurely or they had emigrated. So it was giving these people recognition and telling the story of the revolutionary period really through their mini biographies, if you wish.
Very good. And they include some of the figures from the Fenian Rising. Tell us about Gerry O'Sullivan.
Yes, a remarkable figure, really. His name just popped up in history through the Clerkenwell explosion, and he had the unfortunate, I suppose, he was the unfortunate man who lit the fuse that caused the Clerkenwell explosion. And it may well be argued that the Clerkenwell explosion changed relationship between Ireland and Britain. I know recently Dermot Ferriter had suggested that Ireland had always problems getting the attention of Britain, and the Clerkenwell explosion seems to have changed that inadvertently and not through design, really.
And then he's the man on that rescue mission.
Yes.
Well, talk to me about John Cronin during the War of Independence. He seems to have been something of a maverick.
Yes, Cronin would be, I suppose, what we would be regarded as a hard man, a kind of a dedicated guerrilla fighter, who was to the fore, really, of all the engagements that were here. And even during the winter of 1920, when things were going badly, he was one of the few that decided to keep on fighting. The spring of 1921 saw an upsurge in fighting, and Cronin was to the fore then as well. But unfortunately, during the Civil War, he was interned and developed tuberculosis and died a relatively young man in 1926. Before his story could be told. Again, a forgotten hero of the time, and he's remembered with a roundabout here outside Tralee, but if you asked anybody who he was, he would be just the man the roundabout is called after, rather than a figure in history.
And you mentioned extraordinary men and women. Tell us about the women then.
Yes, they tend to be forgotten, and of course no army can fight without its women backing it up. There was one particular lady, Nan Scully. Nan Scully appeared out of nowhere in the revolutionary period in West Kerry, where she was a nurse who attended the wounded of an ambush. She was just mentioned once in the Bureau of Military History, and it fascinated me who she was. As it turned out, she was the daughter of a Coast Guard in Minard. She was the youngest of a large family and had a little bit of a rebellious streak. I knew nothing about her whatsoever, but she fascinated me. And I gave a lecture on the Lispol ambush, a relatively large engagement in West Kerry in 1921. And a few days later, I got an email from university in Manchester from the granddaughter of this lady, a physicist. And she filled me in on her personal life afterwards. So Nan Scully was a nurse, and she did look after at great risk the wounded volunteers. And when all the men had kind of fled from the area, she stayed with her wounded. She eventually immigrated to England, where she married David Abulafia, who was a Sephardic Jew who changed his name so that he could marry her. So that was Nan Scully, a remarkable lady.
Very good. And there's 22 stories like that in the book. Well, Tim, thanks so much for joining us tonight. The book is called Fighting for the Cause, Kerry's Republican Fighters. It's published in paperback by Mercier Press and costs €19.99. The author, Tim Horgan. And Tim, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
We'll be back with more Talking Bye. History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History on News Talk.
A new book looks at the history of the Holy Land and covers the 3,000 years which saw the rise of Judaism, Christianity and Islam, and relates the familiar stories of the sacred texts with the fruits of modern scholarships. It's called The Oxford Illustrated History of the Holy Land. It's published in hardback by Oxford University Press and costs £30 sterling, so about €34. The editors are Robert G. Hoyland and H.G. M. Williamson. And Robert and Hugh, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Thank you.
Robert, we might begin with you, and we might begin with, I suppose, how the Christians and the Muslims created for themselves the idea of the Holy Land.
They're very different, really. For the Christians, and initially, actually, they started with the idea that the Holy Land was a heavenly entity. But that all changed when Constantine the Great converted to Christianity, and he wanted a more physical representation, particularly his mother, actually, Helena, spent a lot of effort and money building new churches and monasteries and so on, and they wanted relics such as the Holy Cross and so on. So after that, it became very much a physical entity, and many pilgrims arrived wanting to place their feet where Jesus had stood and in the spot where miracles had taken place and so on. The Muslims, it's a little less clear. The Quran does mention the ancient sanctuary of mankind, but not by name, but there's an implication that this was probably Jerusalem, because Jerusalem was the first Qibla, the first direction of prayer for the Muslims. So it obviously was something very special already to the Muhammad's community, so right from his days. And also already from only a few years after the Arab conquest of the Middle East, we see building works in Jerusalem, which then culminates in the 690s with the magnificent Dome of the Rock right on the spot where the ancient Jewish temple had been built.
Very good. And Hugh, it's interesting when you look at the kinds of sources that we have that are archaeological, and then also when we look at biblical references and using that as a source.
Yes, in fact, in the Bible, the expression only occurs once in a rather obscure passage in Zechariah. So as a title, the Holy Land is really rather later when, as Robert has indicated, we begin to get pilgrims and so on. But of course, the concept of the land and the promised land is very central to very earliest times, the promises of land, which really form the heart of many of the early biblical stories. Exactly how they relate to archaeology and history is quite difficult, but as a narrative whereby eventually the Jewish people gain their self-identity, the land is a central element. Interestingly, it's not referred to in the New Testament at all, and the concept of the physical land is rather less important there. But certainly as a defining feature of what became the Jewish faith, the fact that God had promised this land to that people is quite central.
And how important are the Dead Sea Scrolls?
The Dead Sea Scrolls have been called the greatest archaeological discovery of the 20th century. They're an enormous collection of now mostly fragmentary manuscripts from around the century before the time of Jesus and during his lifetime and just after, including copies of the Bible, which of course in those days is what we would call the Old Testament, and many other Jewish religious texts, some of which we already knew, many of which we didn't. And they're important perhaps primarily in two ways. One is that they tell us a great deal more about the nature of Judaism in which Jesus was working. So many references in the New Testament to the way Jesus is referred to and called and so on, we discover were already in the air, as it were, and So that puts Jesus and his work very much more in context. The other thing is that they are about 1,000 years earlier than our previous earliest copies of the Old Testament. So in terms of determining whether the Bible had been copied accurately during those hundreds of years, is a mixed story. Broadly speaking, the Bible is very recognizable. There are quite a lot of small differences, which are very interesting and sometimes allow us to reconstruct the old text a little bit more accurately, but not in major changing ways. They're much more modest changes.
Robert, it's interesting to look at the place when this becomes a contested space. And is that during the Crusader period, or was it always a contested space?
Relatively, Muslims and Christians seem to have shared the Jerusalem fairly well. But it's certainly true that the Crusaders, when they come, because they're also wanting to actually physically claim the space, as in control it as well, then that creates tension. So Muslims had been controlling the land and the Christians hadn't. So in a sense, the Christians had to accept it and they worked out a modus vivendi. But yes, in many, especially holy places of saints that were special to both religions became contested, and sometimes to all three. The most famous case is, of course, Hebron, where it's said that the patriarchs, Abraham, his wife, and so on, were buried. And all three religions had a vested interest in Abraham. So this led to quite a lot of arguments and disputes about where exactly Abraham was buried, who had the right place. Each side would make up stories saying, ha-ha, we actually know where he really was buried, and we don't, and the other two religions don't.
And Hugh, it's interesting to see the position of Jerusalem. In a way, this is also the history of Jerusalem.
Yes, Jerusalem is by far the most... Just look in the index of the book under the heading Jerusalem. It seems to dominate the whole story for many reasons. Obviously, it was the capital of the Kingdom of Judah, David, Solomon, and those who followed. The temple was there. It was where the Jews wanted to return after they'd been taken to the exile in Babylon. And, of course, it becomes central to the mission of Jesus. Interestingly, he didn't come from there himself, of course. He came from up in the north, but the whole drama of the Christian salvation history is played out in Jerusalem. It's quite central to the whole story.
Very good. Well, it's the Oxford Illustrated History of the Holy Land. It's published in hardback by Oxford University Press. Costs about €34. The editors, Robert Hoyland and Hugh Williamson. And Robert and Hugh, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History on News Talk.
A tale of arson, loot and murder was how one source described the events that would befall Cork City on the night of the 11th of December 1920. In a scene of almost unprecedented destruction, members of the British forces, bent on revenge for the ambushes at Kilmichael and Dillon's Cross, set fire to both the commercial and the civic heart of the city. And the story is now being told in a new book by Michael Lenehan. It's called Cork Burning. It's published in hardback by Mercier Press and costs €19.99. And I'm delighted to welcome the author to the show tonight. Michael, you're very welcome.
Thanks, Patrick. Thanks for having me on.
Can we talk then about the lead up to the burning of Cork? Tell me about the ambushes and why the British were so determined to get revenge.
Well, there were several smaller fires occurred in the city prior to the ambushes, but things really cranked up with the Kilmichael ambush. This was the first time really that the auxiliaries had been taken on by the likes of the commanders like Tom Barry in West Cork. And of course, when they had suffered such huge casualties at the time, they took it up in people, really, in the city and in the surrounding areas. I mean, all the houses around Kilmichael near the ambush area at the time were burned to the ground. But as I say, things cranked up in Cork City because not alone then were they starting to burn, we say, the Sinn Féin offices. They also decided to burn down the Irish Transport and General Workers Union on Camden Quay after the ambush, and they prevented the fire brigade from trying to out the fire at the time. Now, they also attacked three premises as well in the city, one of them which had Republican connections, Blackthorn House, and they burned that as well at the time.
And so how dramatic was it the night of the 11th of December then? Did it catch people by surprise that they were so bent on revenge and were determined to cause such destruction?
It caught some people by surprise, but some of the eyewitness accounts, like the eyewitness account from William Roach of Roach's Stores, one of the larger department stores in the city, he really seemed to have foreseen that something was going to happen. And he actually hid all his goods in his warehouses in Merchant Street. And funnily enough, immediately after the fire, he actually had a salvage sale. So he was prepared. But I think the majority of the people in the city were certainly not prepared, and especially not on this scale, not when all the major department stores like Cash's, Munster Arcade, Egan's, Grant's, I mean, these were major department stores. This was a huge portion of the city.
What really shocked me reading the book was the fact that the auxiliaries in the Black and Tans shot at the firemen and cut their hoses and seemed to be determined to cause maximum damage.
That's true. I mean, they were quite irate over what happened, because the same tactics had been employed in the Dillon's Cross ambush as had been deployed at Kilmichael. And they were no longer seemed to be so special that they couldn't actually be attacked. One of the places where they really wanted to burn down, that was the City Hall. And we have eyewitness accounts, and a lot of these eyewitness accounts in my book have never been published before, because they come from the Strickland report, which had been kept hidden till 1998. Now, they were particularly anxious to get to City Hall, and they had made several attempts over the period of months. And three firemen were stationed outside the City Hall to ensure that it wouldn't happen. But on that particular night, they were, as I said, they were determined. They shot at the firemen, they cut the hoses, and there was actually no way of saving the City Hall, which was seen as a hotbed of republicanism at the time.
Talk to me about some of the figures who were involved then at that time. The Lord Mayor, for example, and what role did he play?
Well, it's very interesting, because we had three Republican Lord Mayors. The first Lord Mayor was Tomás McCurtain. He was killed in front of his wife and children. The second Lord Mayor was Terence McSweeney, who died in hunger strike. And the third Republican Lord Mayor at the time, during the actual events, was Donal O'Callaghan. And he had to go in hiding, and he spent his whole mayorship really in hiding in safe houses. And that was a major problem, because he was going to be obviously the next target. And as a matter of fact, he actually made his way on board a ship with Peter McSweeney, Terence McSweeney's brother, to the States to give witness accounts to the American Conditions Report in Ireland, an independent body that was set up. So he was very, very much in danger, and he knew it, and he had to keep in hiding all the time.
Afterwards, it was quite extraordinary that the British government tried to blame Cork's own citizens for what had happened.
Well, that was a major problem, because there's no way that compensation could be paid out if you couldn't establish who the perpetrators of the act were. And when they blamed the citizens, they were trying to exonerate their own forces. But that led to major complications for people trying to claim money from their insurance policies. The first thing that was actually happened in the city was the city hall could do at the time, the corporation, was to announce that they'd lay it on the rates. But they knew that those large sums of money could not be paid out. It wasn't until the treaty negotiations of 1922 that it was actually agreed to pay a compensation for the burnings in 1920.
And talk to me about the compensation. How much compensation was eventually paid, and how difficult was the rebuilding?
Well, the compensation was very interesting, actually, because when I was writing the book, I was concentrating very much on the burning. But when it came to the compensation, it got very complicated, because you had large department stores like the Munster Arcade putting in claims in excess of 400,000, for which they were paid roughly half of that. The problem was there was no proof existed as to how much stock was actually in the buildings when they went on fire, and they could only guess at the rebuilding estimates. So that caused major problems. But another problem that was encountered was 1923, we went into the Civil War. So for the first 3 years, literally nothing had happened in the city. Then there was different problems within different groups. The trade groups got involved. They wanted local tradespeople to rebuild the city. They wanted local material to be used. For instance, Burton's wanted to use Norwegian granite. and the trades were in uproar, and they said you'll have to use Cork limestone. And in the finish, that building was actually finished in Cork limestone, as were the likes of Cashel's and the Munster Arcade.
And Michael, a final question then. What would you see as the legacy of the burning? Did it have a lasting impact on the people of Cork?
Well, the funny thing that I discovered in my researches was that there seemed to be a collective amnesia as to what happened. And I mean, the last shop or premises wasn't completed in 1927. But what we have today is we have magnificent buildings, whereas the old buildings were quite kind of higgly-piggly. The new architecture, for instance, like Roche Stores, which is now Debenhams, a lovely Italianate type of building. The beautiful limestone buildings that exist today, beautiful buildings, Cashel's, built by the Hill Architects, designed by Hill, and Chillingworth and Levy designed the Roche Stores building. So I think the legacy today is that we have wonderful buildings. But, I mean, it must have been a terrible time for the citizens, because the amount of compensation claims, not alone for the big stores, but for the smaller premises, and that's what I cover in my book, the dentists, the dressmakers, the smaller people like photographers. I think the total amount of claims was 605, which was enormous, because not alone were the main streets destroyed, the likes of Winthrop Street, Mailer Street, they were all affected by the fire.
Oh, well, Michael, congratulations on the book. It's called Cork Burning. It's published in hardback by Mercier Press and costs €19.99. The author, Michael Lenhan. And Michael, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Patrick. Thank you very much.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History with me, Patrick Gagan. A new book tells the extraordinary story of how and when the writers took power in Germany in 1918. The book is called Dreamers, When the Writers Took Power. It's published in hardback by the Pushkin Press and costs €16.99 sterling, about €20. The author is Volker Weidermann. And Volker, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Can you tell us this extraordinary story, which I have to admit I had never heard of before? The newly declared Free State of Bavaria, the role of Kurt Eisner, who had been a journalist and theatre critic, and this extraordinary chapter in the history of Germany.
Yeah, actually many people in Germany don't know about it, because it's not so much been talked about it during the last 100 years. Well, there was the end of World War One, the war that Germany obviously could not lose, because they were so optimistic about that they would reign the world for the next decades. So the war was lost, and then the King of Bavaria left Munich because of this disaster, and there was the power lying on the street, and some poets and some theater critics, and like Kurt Eisner, just took the power and said, well, I try to make a better Bavaria, to found the Free State of Bavaria, and it just worked out for at least some months.
And what was it like then in those months? Because it seems to work for a time very well.
Well, for some time it actually worked, because there was the disaster was big, but on the other side there was this big hope that for a new time, for a time that workers and poets and people who have fantasies for a better and completely different world could make things much better, because the disaster was so great. So they had big chances. And yeah, he did start with a new regime, and like also soldiers and workers and people from out of Munich, like people working on the fields, they all said, "Well, let these guys try to reign Bavaria."
And we have some other recognizable names involved: Thomas Mann. It's an interesting collection of, as you say, poets, theatre critics, social democrats, art. It brings together intellectuals in a way that I suppose hadn't been tried there before.
That's true. It was completely new in Germany, obviously, but there was, I mean, these guys did say, we found our political dreams. We did find them not only in ourselves, but also in the history of German literature. They said they found it in the works of Goethe. They saw they found it in the works of Shakespeare, and they said, well, we have all these big books, these big books of ideas. Let's try to make them real. And you're right. I mean, there were on some kind, Munich was kind of the capital of German literature by that time. Yeah, you mentioned the names like Thomas Mann and Heinrich Mann and even the very small Klaus Mann. And on the right wing, there was Stefan George, there was the not political poet Rainer Maria Rilke. And they all said, well, maybe this is our time. Maybe this is the time that literature or this, cloudy theory writing could be changed to a real politic.
And then it then goes horribly wrong. And there seems to be a big backlash against the regime and the administration. The party does badly in the January 1919 election. Eisner himself is assassinated, I think, as he's about to hand over his resignation. And it seems to be criticised and attacked a lot by people who were unhappy with the direction it was taking. It's the criticisms of Prussia and the approach it was taking to the problems that it was facing.
Yes, I mean, we have to face the end of it, as you mentioned. And it was the beginning of the big division of German society in all. On the one side, of course, this defeated dreamers, the left-wing side, and on the other side, the very far right-wing politicians, like an Adolf Hitler, who did celebrate his 30th birthday by that time, didn't have made up his mind what kind of political way he would go. But after this long revolution in Bavaria that was powered especially by Jews and many left-wing Jews said, well, someone has to go in a completely different direction. And this was, at the end, the beginning of the big, big division of German society in political ways. And the moment that made Munich, the capital of Bavaria, the capital of the right-wing movement for the years to come.
And so what was the legacy then of this brief moment in German history? Did it pave the way for Hitler, who you mentioned? Could the history of Germany have gone in a dramatically different way and the history of the world in the 20th century if it had succeeded?
Let's for a second try to think about it. Yeah, I mean, of course it could. The ideas were not bad. The optimism was great and the opportunity was great. But they were also, well, as I say, they were dreamers in a way that they had absolutely no experience. They had no idea how to stay in power and to keep the enemies down. Well, I dream of thinking that it could have gone another way, because the few people in Germany who know about this period all say, well, it was all the fault of these dreamers' fault. They all did wrong. And if they hadn't started this dreamy revolution, we wouldn't have a Hitler in power. But you can also think it the other way around, of course. If they had a bit more experience, had taken, well, like had taken the Social Democrats more serious, maybe, the German and the world history could have gone another way.
Okay, well, thank you so much for joining us to tell the story. The book is called Dreamers, When the Writers Took Power, Germany 1918. It's published in hardback by Pushkin Press and costs about €20. The author, Volker Weidermann. And Volker, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Hey, cool. Thanks very much for your questions.
And that brings us to the end of another edition of Talking History. Before I go, just to say that we are having another outside broadcast in Kilkenny this year. It's going to be in June and it's going to be a good one. And if you want to get tickets, they are, of course, free. Just go to our website, go to the Talking History page and events and sign up. We would love to see you there, and we have a superb panel of experts. But that is the end of the show tonight. My thanks to everyone who put it together, Susan Cattle, my producer, and Chris Bent on sound. Next week it's Easter Sunday and we'll bring you our show on the life and legacy and legend of Muhammad Ali, and we'll find out how he changed the world of sport and celebrity forever. So join us next week on News Talk. We've been talking history. Good night.